What time do you got?
7:30.
Okay. Welcome, everyone. Can you hear me? Can you hear me in the back? Am I making myself cognizant? Is that a word? Welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum, everyone. We are dedicated to bringing philosophy ideas and intellectual discussion to interested audience in the DFW Forum. I'm Rob Olson, and very encouraged to see everyone out. It looks like we have almost a full house. And I guess it was 4 weeks ago we had standing room only. We're almost there, aren't we, David? Almost full house, so we're real excited about that. If you haven't paid already, please do so immediately after the lecture. Our treasurer is David Drum. Cost is $5, the best bargain in town. That's what I always say. And then please remember to pay for your meal, and I don't think they're adding the tip in, are they? I don't think they are, so please provide a generous tip for your wait staff. They do a great job for us. So we have, we have one more session for this, we call it a semester, I guess that's what we call it. We think of ourselves as a university, I guess we call it a semester. Schedule, but we have Freedom, Creativity, and Manipulation, Eric Barnes, PhD from SMU, who will be speaking in 2 weeks. And I think so he's going to deal with determinism and free will and all the things that we argue about as philosophers, armchair philosophers, all the time. And then your Dallas Philosophers Forum board, David Drum, Jack Youngton. Jack has rejoined the board. We're thrilled to have Jack back on the board. He got me involved in Dallas Philosophers Forum many years ago, and Ken Sauter. We're all diligently at work finding speakers for the spring semester. So, anybody interested in politics of anger? We got it. How about objectivity? Anybody interested in objectivity? We got that. How about Africa? I met a guy at the gym who turned out to be a PhD in economics, and he has a not-for-profit organization dealing with developing economic development in Africa. And so we lined him up, so I'm real excited about that. So we extend beyond just the pure philosophy topic. So we're going to have a speaker on Africa. Anybody interested in sex? Nobody? We have deception and consent to sexual relations in March. We have economics of immigration, not Donald Trump, but somebody else can speak on that. 3:22, an attorney on the ethics and economics of immigration should be fascinating. We have an esteemed doctor who's going to be speaking about beauty. Dr. Elkett will be speaking on the biological, sociological, and historical basis of beauty. And he's not only MD, but he's done a lot of cosmetic surgery over the years, so he's the perfect guy to do that. And then managing polarities for fun and profit. So opposites, yin and yang, right, David? And how we manage polarities. So please tell everybody about all these great lectures coming up. Tell your friends how wonderful we are. What is the old saying? That we're like Lake Wobegon at philosophy. All the women are strong. All the men are good looking, and all the children are above average, right? Is that how that works? So in addition, we have a website that has a lot of the same information, www.philosophersforum.org, and you can sign up on our email list. So we have our email directory. We got that going out. We've got Meetup that's out there. And then if you just type in Dallas Philosophy, we'll be near the top of that search engine page. Then, so if you want to sign up for the meetup, you can just go meetup.com, Dallas Philosophers Forum, and you can get signed up on the meetup as well. So our speaker tonight is going to be speaking for about 45 minutes, and I think we often hear that one of the most enjoyable parts of this group is the Q&A. So we try and allow a lot more Q&A than a lot of other organizations because that's what you all like. And so we'll have about 30 minutes for Q&A. And then one last thing, please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate mode at this time. We're very privileged to have Dr. Paul Tomolowski tonight. It's a real treat. He spoke about 3 years ago, and I had so many people say, we got to get this guy back. We got to get this guy back. So tonight, we got him back. I was surfing the web the other day. I was goofing off at work. Does anybody else goof off at work? No. I'm the only one?
Never.
I'm the only one. So I saw a quote that epitomizes Dr. Tomolowski. Let me read it to you. This is Merlin's advice to the young King Arthur in The Once and Future King by T.H. White. The best thing for being sad is to learn something. That is the only thing that never fails. You may grow old and trembling in your anatomies. You may lie awake at night listening to the disorder of your veins. You may miss your only love. You may see the world about you devastated by evil lunatics, or know your honor trampled in the sewers of baser minds. There is only one thing for it then, to learn. Learn why the world wags and what wags for it. That is the only thing which the mind can never exhaust, never alienate, never be tortured by, never fear or distrust, and never dream of regretting. Learning is the thing for you. And Paul Tomolowski epitomizes that quote. He grew up in Dallas, Kimball High School at 65, and a BA in biology at Rice University. How's their football team doing? Usual. Then he graduated University of Texas Southwestern Medical School. He was the class president and the graduation speaker. He's been a great speaker since all that back then. Internal medicine internship and residency in Boston, Massachusetts. From the now non-existent Boston City Hospital, he practiced internal medicine for 30 years, won a lot of awards, and repeated this to best in U.S. He retired in 2009 to write Stardust Dancing, A Seeker's Guide to the Miraculous, which he spoke on about 3 years ago. And so he's given many, many talks, probably over 100 talks on that book, probably, something like that.
Yes.
Happily married for 36 years to his lovely wife, Judy. Judy, you want to? Judy, and then their two sons. Two sons are here as well. We welcome the Tomolowskis. Dr. Tomolowski was speaking this evening on how the brain works and neurochemistry of the mind. And now, please join me in welcoming Dr. Paul Tomolowski.
Can you hear me?
No.
Oh, not yet.
Now. Now? Can you hear me?
A little more.
A little more?
Just keep talking.
Can you hear me now? Jenny had me singing lessons once. Oh, what do you think? Is that enough at the back? Can you hear? Okay. Well, we're going to talk about mind and brain, and it probably takes more than 45 minutes, depending upon how much I forget. It could run up to an hour. I don't. It never comes out the same twice. And I intentionally am not going to address the religious implications of what I have to say, because it's a mixed group. So those of you who are religious, I want to tell you lots of amazing things. And you just interpreted this is the way God did it all. He did all these things, set up all these laws, made all these things happen. And those of you who aren't, and that look at it as chemistry over time, honed by evolution, well, you're right too. Everybody's right. I'm not challenging anyone's core beliefs. It should be an amazing saga. But what I do want to talk about is mind and brain and their overlap. And I would say through most of human history, or at least a lot of it, it was presumed that the mind was something separate from the brain, and that it wasn't recognized the extent to which the brain generated the mind. And science is just beginning to figure all this out, but I would suggest that if you had, say, six of the house margaritas over the course of the talk, you would appreciate that the brain certainly has something, a significant amount to do with the mind. You would find your mind altered by chemical exposure. And Let me start a little bit before my topic, the prequel to my topic. So if you've heard me talk before, I read Stardust Dancing, you know that you're made up of atoms that were once floating around the galaxy before there was an Earth. And then the atoms came together to form the Earth. So the amazing thing where our story starts taking off is that all these atoms were lifeless, had no intelligence, obviously had no emotions, yet they came together and collectively, groups of atoms began possessing the quality of life. And any living thing that's ever existed has made this leap. It's made up of lifeless atoms bunched together, including me. So all your component parts are lifeless, and here you are at the Philosopher's Forum. So that process is called emergence. No one really knows for sure how it happened, but the idea of emergence is that you start with a low level of organization of ingredients, and then as you raise them up to a higher level of organization, amazing things can happen, such as you can get amoebas and whales and elephants and asparagus just by putting atoms together in just the right way. So the current thinking about the mind is that it's also the process of emergence, that the brain puts atoms together in just the right way so that they're able to generate the thoughts that you think and the emotions that you experience. And maybe some of you already believe that and maybe not, but we'll start from that. And so we'll, unfortunately, a lot of what's known about mind to brain is from things that went wrong. I guess a lot of medical discoveries have been made by things that went wrong. So, for example, all the professional football players now that smash their heads against each other as a career choice and end up with early onset dementia, well, that would suggest that smashing heads together does something to brains that affects the mind of the person whose head has been smashed. I myself once played football. Maybe you could tell from this powerful build that it wasn't a good choice. And I also had a concussion. And the brain does lots of things other than the mind. The brain tells you when to breathe. It is the boss of your hormonal system for the most part. If I want to move this finger, my brain operates it. So our brains do an innumerable list of things other than generate the mind, but that's not our topic for tonight. So we're going to talk about what happens to, how do we, from a bunch of atoms, generate our mind. So we were fortunate enough to get a picture of your brain here that's been color-coded, and I've been to the back of the room, so I know you can't see too much detail there. But the front of your brain, you're looking from the left side. So here's my profile and your profile. So you are looking at the left hemisphere of your brain. The front of it is that white part. The back of it is this blue part here. So we're going to talk about some parts of the brain that deal with functions of the mind. And talk. And unfortunately, as I say, about 100, 150 years ago, people started doing autopsies on brains of people that had damage to their brain and matching up the areas with the damage. So this front part, the white part there, that's the prefrontal cortex. And it is a very versatile part of your brain. This is where it's thought that the executive function of the brain is. So many of your brilliant ideas are thought to originate in that prefrontal cortex. I was a doctor for all those years, so I filled mine with a lot of medical information. You can think about what you filled yours. I also filled mine with sports trivia, which has not been quite as much help in life. But we make a lot of our decisions, irrational decisions, it is thought, in this area of the brain, the front of the brain, and try to remember in your short-term memory these locations, because we're going to look at some schemas in a minute. So the back of the brain is involved with vision. So right now, you're looking at the slide. Light is, photons of light are bouncing back off the screen into your eye and striking the retina that you have at the back of each of your eyes. From that, so your eyes are obviously in front of your brain, so connections all the way to the back of your brain feed in to this part of the cortex. Well, it turns out that there's about 30 different areas of the brain that deal with assembling a visual image. That's not the way we experience it. We have the experience that there's a me in here, and I'm looking out through these two windows of my eyes at the world. That's our experience of it. But it's much more amazing than that, because light is absorbed in the eyes. Light has nothing to do with what happens in forming the visual image after it's absorbed by your eyes. Instead, it's all the firing of nerves. Nerves fire to get to this hookup and back. And then there's these 30 subcommittees or so that are formed that are evaluating different aspects of the signal. So some are looking for lines slanted like that, and some are looking for lines slanted like that, and some are looking for borders. Some committees are looking for faces. Some are looking for specific faces. And so somehow, from all this fragmented imaging, these committees assemble your visual experience of the outside world. Well, I'm pretty impressed that we can do this. And we can obviously do it fairly accurately, because we all probably got here by car. And so clearly, we can experience position and velocity fairly accurately. It's interesting that color is not thought to exist in the outside world in the way that we experience it. Probably different species see the same outside world but in a different color scheme. And so remember, for our present purposes, that vision is a way that we assemble light photons striking our eye and the work of lots of committees working together. Now, hearing is more properly known as audition, A-U-D-I-T-I-O-N. And so that's even more interesting and weird, because what I'm doing is breathing out through vibrating vocal cords, and I'm generating high and low pressure waves that travel through the air to you. And I'm shaping those pressure waves with my lips and my tongue and my jaw and my palate. So I am sending you shaped pressure waves. From that, you assemble this auditory experience of the universe that it has nothing apparently to do with shaped air pressure waves. You hear a human, you hear a voice, and it's thought that you the current thinking is that you are constructing my voice out of the pressure waves that I've sent to you. The tree falling in the forest question, it is currently presumed, though there's no way to prove or disprove it, but what I am sending out is shaped pressure waves, and what you are experiencing is that Jeannie gives me singing lessons, or did. Jeannie's a great singer, as you may guess. I'm not any better at that than I was at football. But this area 41 and 42 is what's called the auditory cortex. So your eardrums are now vibrating in and out with the force of the pressure waves that I've sent your way. They send nerve signals to this area 41 and 42, and that would all be meaningless gibberish if you didn't have area 22 here, and that's called Wernicke's area, W-E-R-N-I-C-K-E. Wernicke's area makes sense out of language. So I am trying with my Wernicke's area to encode in language meaning, ideas, and then you are using your Wernicke's area to decode it. And I can tell you I've seen patients that had strokes that knocked out Wernicke's area, and you talk to them and they can't understand what you're saying, even though their ears are perfect. I've had one patient that had a stroke that knocked out the visual cortex, and even though their eyes were perfect, they could not make a big visual representation of the world. So one of the teaching company programs on the brain, Dr. Norden, who gave the course, says you construct your realities with your brain. You construct your visual reality and your auditory reality with your brain. So for the auditory part, you have the 41 and 42, those tan areas that receive it. Remember these positions. Right in back of it is Wernicke's area that makes sense of it. Then if you want to talk yourself, you need these, what, golden areas here, 44 and 45, called Broca's areas. And I've seen people that had strokes, that their comprehension is fine, their hearing's fine, but they can't get the words out. Broca's area is not functioning. So if you've got the general relationship, let me see if the...
This will be a little turn on, right?
Yeah, I've got it.
Oh, you have it. Yeah.
So I'm guessing the fact you may not be able to see these, but I'll talk you through them. And this is how your brain works. So we talked about the sensory input. So I told you a lot was learned about the brain due to damage to it. Now you get to see it in action. You get to see what parts light up on the scan. So PET scans and functional MRI scans, the areas that light up are the ones that have increased metabolism and are presumably involved in the task that you're studying. So this first one says passively viewing words. Is it at all visible in the back? Slightly visible? Okay, passively viewing words. So think about that task. You're just looking at the words. So your visual cortex at the back of the brain, again, you're looking at the brain in profile. The visual cortex is active, and I've told you there's about 30 other areas in the brain that pitch in to interpret the signal. So you see dots of activity elsewhere in the brain. So we're going to call that the visual module of the brain. So whenever you're looking at anything, your visual module is going to be active. Now this upper right one says listening to words. So if I told you close your eyes, and now I'm going to just say words and you're going to have a PET scan, you could see that the visual area in the back of the brain has now gone off. It's gone dark. You've shut your eyes, so you've turned off your visual module. Instead, your auditory modules have turned on. You're listening to words, so your auditory cortex lights up, and the area right in back of it, Wernicke's area, is lighting up. So you've turned on a different set of modules for the task of listening to words. This lower left picture is speaking words. So I say blue, say purple. So you're hearing me say the words. So your auditory cortex is lighting up, but to speak the word, Broca's area, that part that is responsible for you being able to verbalize them, has to also light up. So you've turned off your visual cortex because you're just speaking, and you have a different set of modules activated. This fourth one in the lower right, generating verbs. So here, you're in the PET scanner, and I give you the name of an animal, and you have to come up with a verb associated with the animal. So if I say dog, you say bark. or if I say horse, you say gallop. So you think about the task. You have multiple tasks that are involved in this apparently simple activity. So you have to hear it. You have to hear my cue. So that's active. You have to think about what's the right verb. So now we see action in the prefrontal area of the brain. You have to have your Wernicke's area come up with translating it into meaning. You have to have your Broca's area activated to say the word, but you don't need your visual cortex, so it's turned off. So here's the take-home. There are several take-home messages from this. So I have this feeling that for 68 years, I've been me, a consistent personality, that there's continuity in my personality. But what is presumed that I've actually been doing, no one has found a spot in the brain that seems to correspond with this sense of me. Instead, with the situations we face, we continually assemble committees of modules to deal with the situation we're in. So your whole life, every second, every couple seconds, your situation's changing and you keep seamlessly assembling new committees and modules to deal with your situation. You turn off the modules that you're not using. You turn on the modules that are active. So, and not everything that's so there's competition between the modules, but the ones that win are the ones that you need to address your situation. Not all the modules are you conscious of. Like right now, we shut off, even though I hear noise from the kitchen or from the restaurant, I'm not conscious of that. I have to stand. I'm not conscious of that, but I'm doing it. So it's thought that the part that we're conscious of is only a small part of the input that we're being bombarded with. Our body is good at selecting out the parts that we need in facing the situation that we're in at any given time. Now, the modules can be in conflict. So somebody could be my great friend, and 98% of the time we have a wonderful time together, but they just said something that really hacks me off and activates the wrong combination of modules. What do I do? Well, I make a mistake if I respond with that wrong set of modules to a part of them that is not very representative of the way they usually are. So counting to 10 is a good idea when you're upset, because it allows modules to cool off that maybe should stay cooled off. So what you're doing then throughout your life is you continually change teams of modules, assembling new committees of modules all the time. Now, this is from a Scientific American article in 2012, and I probably shouldn't go through all the details, but this is now what's called the limbic system of the brain, and this is the part of the brain that generates emotions. Right here is the amygdala, and the amygdala, A-M-Y-G-D-A-L-A, is in charge of your personal safety. And remember, like all the areas of the brain, it's not exposed to the outside world. All the information it gets is nerves feeding in, electrical stimuli, and chemical neurotransmitters feeding in. But if the amygdala becomes aware through sensory input that there's a lion escaped from the zoo that's just made its way into the room, your amygdala is going to start firing. And as Wynn told us the meeting before last, when the amygdala fires, you better listen. Because it's warning you, and it will fire off lots of false alarms, because if you miss one tiger coming into the Delphinix, you get it. You don't want to miss the one tiger. And the price we pay of it is we spend a lot of our time anxious for no good reason, because our amygdala is saying, well, could be a dangerous situation, could be dangerous. And so anxiety is programmed into us as a sort of defense mechanism. Well, the areas in blue here are areas involved in wanting. So it's good to want some things to a certain extent. If you didn't want anything, you'd be lying in bed all the time. So, doesn't sound all that bad, I know, but it's not your full potential. And on the other hand, if you want too much, you're never satisfied. You get something, not enough. You gotta get something else. Get something else. If it's overblown too much, those are addictions. So if you have a gambling addiction or an alcohol addiction or a drug addiction, it's because this pathway, these blue parts, are overpowered. Ventral tegmental area, nucleus accumbens, parts of the cortex, the amygdala. So that is the part of the brain that deals with this often motivating sense of desire. Let's go to the areas in pink, and these are areas involved in conscious pleasure. So if these get activated, you feel pleased. It's called the endogenous reward system. So you have to figure out what activates your endogenous reward system. Chocolate cake might. It turned out football didn't do it for me. But you probably find activities, as Rob says, hopefully you're here tonight, because learning activates your endogenous reward system. That's hopefully why people would come to the Philosopher's Forum. So you have parts of the brain that generate emotions. Well, again, how do they do it? No one knows how they do it. It's presumed that it's an emergent property of the brain. And if someone has a stroke that knocks out some of these areas, they lose that capability. What is not drawn on this map, there's arching back from the amygdala, is a part called the hippocampus. It's not in the plane that this cut is in. The hippocampus seems to be the gateway to our memory. Memory gets stored mostly in the cortex, but there was a patient that for seizures, I believe, had his hippocampus removed on each side. He could no longer form any new memories. He could access his old memories, but he couldn't form any new ones. That's unfortunately one way that it was discovered, that the hippocampus is the key to bringing in new memories. And the hippocampus is one of the first areas that's damaged in Alzheimer's disease, a degenerative disease in the brain that turns into damage to the mind. So there's always this battle between wanting, between feeling pleasure, and how does this take place? I would mention in adolescence, it's thought the emotional part of the brain ramps up under the test. Suddenly there's all this testosterone and estrogen are ramping up the emotions, whereas the calculating cortex doesn't fully mature until someone's 25 or 30. So you got this little gap from about 13 to about 30 where people may not be making their decisions based on the soundest of calculations. They're following those hormones in the wrong direction sometimes. The picture at the lower left introduces how brain cells communicate with each other, and it's called the chemistry of liking. Think about that, the chemistry of liking. And it shows two nerves, one's coming in from the upper left, and one, here's another nerve on the right side of that little picture there. So you have about 100 billion neurons in your brain. The gap between two neurons is called a synapse, S-Y-N-A-P-S-E, and each of your 100 billion neurons has about 1,000 synapses, so that gives you about 100 trillion synapses in your brain. So to put that in context, that's more stars than there are in the Milky Way galaxy. That's more galaxies than there are in the more than the number of galaxies in the observable universe. So that's how much computing power you have in your brain. But no two nerve cells actually touch each other. They communicate with chemicals. And so this nerve in the limbic system is communicating with this one by releasing chemicals. Well, the chemicals are called neurotransmitters. So that's the method of communication within the brain, within nerves. So if an electrical activation of this nerve coming down from the upper left takes place, it releases these neurotransmitters. Well, in this chemistry of liking, the neurotransmitters are called enkephalins. And you perhaps have heard of endorphins and enkephalins, and this you should find kind of wild. You may know endorphin means endogenous morphine. It's a short for endogenous morphine. So your brain produces narcotic-like substances. And in this chemistry of liking, endorphin and enkephalin is the neurotransmitter on this particular circuit. Furthermore, what happens when a neurotransmitter is released is it drifts across the synapse, attaches to receptors on the next nerve, and that activates or inactivates the next nerve. Some neurotransmitters are stimulating, some are suppressive. But in the chemistry of liking, it causes the next nerve to release this chemical called anandamide. And let me read the text here. Anandamide, the brain's version of marijuana. Your brain thought of it before you did. So you've got, in this chemistry of liking, morphine-like neurotransmitters causing the release of marijuana-like anandamide. And then this particular hookup can feed back on itself with the anandamide to cause more enkephalins to be released, to cause more anandamides to be released. So maybe you feel that when you're playing tennis or eating enchiladas. If all these things work in balance, you have a fairly normal life. If any of them are overpowering, you're either really good at something or really bad at something. And a lot of us, we're not usually equal in everything. I don't have a picture of two nerves meeting, but I can give you an idea. The color on this is a false coloration, but it shows a nerve cell going to a muscle cell. And so you can see these, they're called vesicles that contain neurotransmitters. You see it's just loaded, the end of the nerve is just loaded with neurotransmitters. And so if the brain, if my brain, I want to move that finger, I activate the nerve going to that finger, it releases these neurotransmitters that drift across this synapse, this junction, they activate the muscle to contract. Well, the neurotransmitter for between nerves and muscles is called acetylcholine. It was originally, when I first started getting into this, it was thought there were about 60 neurotransmitters, new ones keep being found, 70, 80, I've seen estimates of up to 100 now. So what you've got is 100 trillion synapses, and some of these neurotransmitters are confined to small areas of the brain, some are in broad areas of the brain, but somehow you represent reality by electrical stimulation of nerves causing release of neurotransmitters that either activate or inactivate the next nerve. So let me tell you how to visualize a nerve in the brain. So think of a tree, the part of a tree that's above ground. So you've got all these branches at the top, and that part of the nerve is called the dendrites, and those are where the 1,000 other nerves feed in. So those 1,000 nerves feed into the dendrites and release neurotransmitters, and some of those neurotransmitters are saying, fire, fire, do it. And some of the other nerves that feed into it are saying, don't do it, don't fire, because you have to have ways of turning nerves on and to turning nerves off, and sometimes the balance is one way and sometimes it's another. But if a nerve fires, then an electrical impulse sweeps down the nerve to the end of it, causing it to release its neurotransmitters. And I drew a little cartoon, you can see why I made a C in art in both the 7th and 8th grade. I didn't draw all 1,000 nerves feeding into the next nerve. I drew 3 of them. And the idea is, let's say that this first one was the nerve we're talking about. So it's got its 1,000 nerve synapsing with it. And we're going to say that the stimulus was strong enough for it to fire. It releases its neurotransmitters. They react with receptors on the next nerve. And then the next nerve fires, it will release its neurotransmitters, which will either stimulate the next nerve to fire or tell it not to fire. But the next nerve is going to be just one of 1,000 voices talking to the next nerve in line. So you have, for each of your nerves, on average, about 1,000 nerves whose signal is being added up. When you learn, you are building, so the act of learning is building strong synaptic connections that persist. So if you've learned something, either you built up more neurotransmitter there, or you built up more receptors there, you've made hookups that persist. So you've got all these hookups in your brain, and if you remember back to our scan, where parts of the brain are turning on or off, what's happening that turns the parts on is the yeses, the stimulating neurotransmitters went out. What happens to the areas that get turned off is the neurotransmitters that are turning things down went out. And so you're constantly having, so you translated this entire world into electrical impulses and neurotransmitters and use that to represent the outside world. Now, the emotion part that we talked about before is really quite critical, because you probably think of yourself as a rational person. But if you think about the decisions you make, I bet they're not always rational. Jack Emkin and I have talked about this. A lot of our decisions, we make a quick decision on an emotional level, after which we can try to construct a rational chain of reasoning. What do you think about gun control? You know, and you knew it instantly what you thought about gun control, and it's going to take you 6 minutes now to tell me the arguments by which you came up with that, but you came up with it immediately. And it's that for a lot of our decisions. So emotion not only helps us make our decisions, why would we have emotions? Why would evolution keep emotions in the way we view the world? Well, there's a famous case of one person who had surgery and became emotionless, like Mr. Spock on Star Trek. And he could not make a decision. He could come up with reasons to do it, reasons not to do it. He couldn't solve anything. So he couldn't make decisions in his life. The other thing that, so emotions determine what we remember. They determine what choices we make in life. What are you going to do tomorrow? And I bet a lot of it's because you want to activate those endogenous pleasure hookups. There's also what a Jack Pinesepp calls a rage circuit in that limbic system. And so you have this ongoing battle, and through it all, the average person is mostly happy most of the time. And that's the set point for most of us. So what I would say then is that the current evidence is that our mind is a function of our brain. Our brain does much more, but our mind's what generates our thoughts, generates our emotions. Our memories are all encoded. TV series on the brain, if any of you recently watched it, he said the common language of the brain is the electrical impulses and the neurotransmitters. Let me just tell you a couple more neurotransmitters as an example, and then we'll move to the questions. So those wanting circuits, the commonest neurotransmitter is dopamine. So people that have addictions, for example, it's because the dopamine circuits, those blue circuits, are too strong. What did I do with this? Wrong direction. So these blue circuits using dopamine as a neurotransmitter are too strong, and that's what gives people alcohol addictions or any addictive behavior. We talked about the pleasure circuits using the endorphins and enkephalins. Go to this one. So antidepressants. The commonest family of antidepressants are the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Celexa, Lexapro. What could be more mind-related than a person's mood? So if you construct a view of reality that is an overly depressive one, serotonin is one of the neurotransmitters. It's released, it attaches to the next nerve, and somehow that generates emotion, our emotional state. Well, all the neurotransmitters have to have a method for inactivating them, or else you'd stay in the same mood forever, the same frame of mind forever. It'd be pretty boring. So what happens to serotonin is, after it's released, it's taken back up by the nerve that released it. The reuptake of serotonin is what this family of antidepressants blocks. So if someone takes Prozac, it blocks their ability to take back up serotonin. And for some reason, that translates for a lot of people into their mood being less depressed. Again, no one knows how from inanimate atoms that this happens, and it doesn't work for everybody. Whenever I put someone on an antidepressant, I always say, please call me if it's an adverse effect for you. Sometimes someone would have exactly the opposite effect than what we predicted, hoped for. So antidepressants, anything that acts on the brain is acting on synapses. So in medicine, you take another example is caffeine. So caffeine's a stimulant. Well, how does that work? There's a neurotransmitter called adenosine that is released, and adenosine is a calming neurotransmitter. It would react with these receptors and exert its calming effect unless you take caffeine. So if you take caffeine attaches to those adenosine receptors and blocks the adenosine from being able to get in there. So the calming effect of adenosine is blocked, and people find themselves more stimulated, more hyper, and that's probably why they had the caffeine in the first place. But again, your deepest emotional content can be affected by things you take by mouth. There's very clear evidence that the physical brain is required for emotions. If you damage parts of the brain, you lose what you consider the mind, features of the mind. You can see on scans that those parts of the brain are activated when people have mental experiences. And you can take chemicals, pills, that affect the neurotransmitters that affect your mind, either the clarity of your thought or your emotions. So my wish for you then would be that you form strong synapses, that you continue to learn and form strong synapses. Remember that the things you repeat are going to keep those synapses formed and strong. So drop the baggage. If you have negative experiences that you are dragging around with you, you are keeping those synapses strong. Let go. Let go of those synapses. May you find activities that activate your endogenous pleasure centers and avoid the rage circus. I look forward to your questions and comments, and Judy is waving the book at me, so I do, with some apology, say it's the gift-giving season, and so if your friend doesn't have a shirt, buy him a shirt, but if he's got a shirt already, and probably he does, for $15, you could either be the person possessor or giver of Stardust Dancing, which would tell you how amazing you are. And I thank you for coming out so close to Halloween.
Questions?
Oh, thank you so much. It was a great presentation. I was wondering if you could go back to the scans that you presented earlier. The question I have is a developmental question. For both physicians, we know our kids, when they grow up and they get to be our age, and with all the problems they're to obtain. But I wonder if, in your study of this area, whether or not you were able to see a developmental change in these particular areas of the brain. And also tied in with that is, okay, so I'm listening. I'm supposed to be listening to you. And so maybe if I really want to hear what you have to say, I should be closing my eyes so that center, that visual center, really does shut off so I can really listen to what you're saying. Any comments on that developmentally as well as here in this room now?
Well, I think one of those is really a profound question. So you're continually building your future mind. Everything you do is building your future mind. So anything you learn is building your future mind. Any experiences that you have are building your future mind. So to the extent that people have been scanned over the course of time, Dr. Barker, I can't speak to that. But always you want to think about what you want to do for your future mind. If you have those six margaritas, you're building your future mind in a way that you probably don't want. So you are building connections. Even these connections that you build are too small to show up on the scans of the type that we have now. Now, the other part to your question was, should you shut your eyes? And I think you should. When I go to the symphony, I'm distracted by watching that. And people that have deficits, like people that are born blind, well, what do they do with that part of the cortex? It's not left fallow. They use it for other senses. Musicians that play instruments, they're changing their brain. And for example, a violinist or a pianist will dedicate a larger part of their brain to their fingers, the representation of their fingers. So what you do at any given time is building your future brain. And so you want to act with wisdom in terms of what you're doing with your future brain. Excellent question.
Okay. Any questions for
you? Hello.
Hi.
Sure. I work with a number of students, and I work with students in the gaming community. And I see in the gaming community a lot of pressures that I didn't see in my big games and in video games. They're playing these things for $1 million in teams. There's $1 million tournament every 3 months. These are very information-rich environments. They're very information-dense environments. These kids are making 6 decisions a second per, you know, on average for, you know, 30 and 45-minute blocks. And they're taking Adderall, just doping it, for years at a time. Right, you know, and in fact, like, you know, you kind of age out about 18 or 19 in that situation. Talking about building the brain of the future, right, what happens to these kids? Right, you see what I'm saying? It's a drug-enhanced situation. They describe it to me as moving from, like, watching high-definition television a lot of the time, and then coming back to reality, and reality is kind of like a low-definition television after this period of time.
Right. Well, I think the future, this technology is also new, that we don't know what's going to happen to them when they're 50. But there's been a great trend toward medicating people that was not present in our parents' generation. So kids take Adderall. People take medicine for lots of things that they used to be told buck up, and so that affects the neurotransmitters in the brain. Neurotransmitters get used to having Adderall in their system, and when you turn it off, it's a big deal, or they get used to having tranquilizers in their system. So I think all decisions need to be made thoughtfully by doctors in that it's not casual when you start people on medicines that affect neurotransmitters. I think any of our jobs affected our future. We're all here built and scarred by our experiences that we've had. It'll be interesting to see what happens to that generation.
I enjoyed your talk this evening.
Well, thank you for that, Paul.
My question, or my comment is, I was fascinated by the discussion of neurotransmitters and how the process works and what particularly happens in the case of addictions and so forth. And when we talk about drugs or alcohol, that's a chemical kind of thing. But then you talk about gambling, and there's no chemical involved there. What's going on in the brain? Does the brain produce that kind of thing?
Yes.
I have a related question then.
Let me tell you one other neurotransmitter, which is somewhat mind-blowing. Oxytocin, perhaps you've heard of. Oxytocin is involved in deep personal bonding. So
nursing mothers have output of oxytocin as a neurotransmitter. So lovers having sexual intercourse have an outpouring of neurotransmitters. So even, and then 60 Minutes had a segment about 2 months ago about dogs and their owners, when they see each other, have an outpouring of oxytocin. So even love and deep personal affection are thought to be chemical, even though it seems like the stimulus isn't. But, a quote of Stephen Johnson, right now, if you read these words, you are under the influence of chemicals that are, molecularly speaking, almost indistinguishable from drugs if you get you arrested, if you consume them openly in a public place. So begin with this basic premise. You are on drugs. With every shifting mood, every twitch of anxiety, every lovelorn glance, you are experiencing the release of dedicated chemicals in your brain that control your emotions. So what doesn't appear to be drugs in the outside world is translated in the brain to electricity and neurotransmitters, electrical impulses and neurotransmitters.
Okay. Now my follow-up comment is, a lot of treatment of mental disease, illness, so on and so forth, is these days pharmaceutical drugs. But what you talked about, if language can, and if the brain can produce that addiction or that disease by itself without drugs, can't the cure, can't the treatment of it be also more counseling, or, you know, does talking have any role in the treatment of mental disease?
It remains controversial which is more important, and I think psychiatrists have gotten more into doing drugs and giving medicine and less into talking to people. And so psychologists have taken over the role of talking to people, and psychiatrists usually do drugs. Now, if someone's addicted to drugs, all changes have to be made gradually. You cut someone off cold turkey from drugs, and that's very difficult on the brain to do. And so you usually need the guidance of someone who's skilled in slowly withdrawing the drugs. I'm not knocking drugs. I'm saying that all of them have an effect on the chemistry of the brain. And so I would hope, fortunately I haven't had personally to deal with it, but I feel like I would want someone to talk to as well as someone to help with medication. I think they have to complement each other. I don't want to feel that I'm just going in for 15 minutes and having someone say, now take this and come see me in 3 weeks or 3 months or whatever. So I hope they complement each other, right?
Dr. Elkick has a question.
Hi, Paul. You've enlightened us with the neuroanatomy and neurophysiology, but you kind of teased us with that word consciousness at the first of your talk. And I'd like to know, in your mind, where that thing lies called consciousness, if there is a place, and or what it's made of. And to follow that up, if it is, you know, neurophysiology, then it is only a qualitative difference between us and other animals. Do they have a consciousness? And if it's just anatomy, then artificial intelligence, you know, can they light up consciousness or self-consciousness also?
Can you tack on 3 more questions to that?
The first one on consciousness, no one has found a specific spot in the brain that can be called the seat of consciousness. So one theory is that
the difference between me hearing your question, of which I'm conscious, and me hearing the dishes rattling, of which I'm not conscious, is that me hearing the dishes doesn't get beyond the small part of my brain. The auditory input gets in there and activates the auditory cortex and doesn't go beyond that. Whereas your question has activated lots of parts of my brain. My prefrontal cortex has had to think about the answer. It is currently thought that if you can get wide connections throughout the brain with the stimulus, then you will be conscious of that stimulus. And the ones that, like, I'm not seeing that painting on the back wall. It's made it to my visual cortex, but not spread through the remainder of my brain. So that's the current feeling, is that consciousness is the spread of a stimulus throughout the brain. Now, as for whether other animals have it, I certainly would think to varying degrees they do. And there's that 60 Minutes segment was doing scans on dogs, and it turned out that when dogs sniffed perspiration from their owner, I think it was the caudate nucleus, some part of the pleasure circuit that corresponds to the pleasure circuits in humans was being activated in those dogs. So the dogs seemed to have the same oxytocin response and activation of the pleasure circuits in their brain on scan. And I don't remember the third question.
Artificial intelligence.
So David Eagleman on TV, on the series on the brain, wrestled with this question of artificial intelligence. And he said there's no way right now to test whether a machine has actual intelligence with which he deals with the problem, it deals with the problem, or whether it's just learned how to feedback properly to you to give the impression of intelligence. So he's thinking that it will be developable at some time in the future, but it's currently untestable and hard to figure out how to test whether the machine actually has intelligence or is just cleverly programmed.
I read your book, but I don't remember. It's been a long time. You started out and you made a differentiation in, between brain and mind. You used two words. And I want to know, is there a difference or is it the same thing? And if there is a difference, what is the relationship between brain and mind?
So I feel like the current thinking is mind is an emergent property of brain. The brain generates mind, but brain does lots of other things. When I want to do the twist, my brain allows me to do that. When my brain is telling my lungs to breathe as we talk, my brain is the quarterback of my body and involved with lots of systems in my body, so it does lots of things in addition to generating a mind.
What is a mind then?
Well, in the sense that I'm using it, it's the part of us that generates our thoughts and emotions.
Okay.
So it's felt.
I was looking for a philosophical answer rather than just a biological.
Right. So that it is thought currently that our thoughts and emotions are based on the parts of the brain that make the right neurotransmitters and make the right hookups that generate thought. So if each of us was being scanned right now while we're talking, you'd know what parts of our brain were involved in this process, which we're creating module teams that generate our thoughts, is the current thought, Mr. Juncker.
So my question is, do you think we should have any existential angst over the someday that we'll know down to the most reductionist level how the brain works, that it will somehow diminish or affect our sense of wonder and awe to perceive things that are miraculous?
A great question. So Dr. Jeanette Norden in the Teaching Company course deals with that question. So she says, if you experience love, is it more satisfying to say that it's based on nothing? That it's based on some that just is? Or is anything lost if you say there's a physical mechanism for it? Is it of any less impact in your life or in the affairs of the world if there's a physical mechanism for it? Because you feel the same love, and so her feeling and my feeling is that it's not diminished in any way if there's a physical mechanism for it. And, thank you. Thanks for that important question. Next.
That's right. First of all, I wanted to say, I think I'm speaking for most of us that we really, really enjoy your topic and, you know, learning more things tonight. So I'm really happy to be here. But I want to ask a very mundane question, because when you look around, some of us are over 60, and some of us have experienced short-term memory loss. So you talked about Broca's area, which, you know, comes in with words, and then you talk about what the hippocampus, which has to do with memory. And then, so that's part one of the question. Why is it when you age that you lose some of the short-term memory? But the second part of the question, even more interestingly enough for me, is you know the word, and you sit there, and you're fishing and fishing, and it won't come to you. And then 10 minutes later, it's there. And you weren't even thinking about that topic, yes. But suddenly, yes. You know, today it happened to me. I saw a cardiac chart with algorithms on it, and you know, algorithm is not a very unusual word for me to use, but it wasn't there, and I knew it, and I kept talking logic. You know, my brain was fishing to find the right thing. Could you explain what part? Maybe we could see the other chart. Is working or failing to send the right signals to get this, because I'm sure I'm not the only one who has a problem.
But I think our consciousness is narrow, and the hookup that you're trying to find is intermittently there. I do that with names a lot. What's their name? What's their name? And but the hookup is there. And I think we do make it harder on ourselves when we press and I can't think of it, I can't think of it. And a lot of times when you relax, the hookup, the synaptic hookups that you made appear, so that, like, you needed this to hook to this, to hook to this, to hook to that, to come up with the thing you're trying to remember. Once your mind calmed down, the proper hookups were there, and you found it. So a lot of things that we know are not in our, we can't remember them permanently, but they're there if we give ourselves a chance. My wife and I have agreed that we have to stay married forever, because each of us can only remember half of anything. It starts with an H. Horace, no, it's not Horace, and eventually the two of us come up with, it was Jack Wilson. And the other thing is, like everything else in our body, people didn't used to live to be past 60. They peaked young, bred young, mated, were strong young, they had to be smart young. And so we're sort of living off the largesse of how wonderful we were when we were younger. So some of that persists, but our bodies and our minds are not what they were when we were 20, but aren't we so wise now?
Okay, we're about out of time, but I want to close with one question. I just finished reading Willie Nelson's autobiography, and he talks lowly of pot. And I haven't smoked pot in 35 years, but I'm thinking about revisiting
It's a lot stronger now.
It's a lot stronger. But he's had an amazingly productive life. I mean, just think about the songs he's written, the albums he's produced. And he attributes a lot of that to marijuana. I have another friend who's been a successful pilot. He had to give up marijuana when he became a pilot, but he's done very, very well. But then I've known people that smoke marijuana, and then they develop cocaine addicts and heroin addictions and all that. So the two reactions, the good reaction, a la Willie Nelson, and then the bad reaction, it's the same drug, but the pleasure centers of the brain then interpret that in different ways. Is that the distinction? And
right, that we're all individuals, and we don't have predictable responses to anything. It would be the same if it was golf we're talking about, where some people love it and some people hate it. And through our emotions, we personalize the world for ourselves. So we look at the same objective reality, but you love one thing and you hate that and you love something else. So you could say that same thing about anything, Rob, that we each are searching for what brings us satisfaction. And
but it has a biological basis.
It has a biological basis. If the current thinking is correct and the currency of the brain is electrical activity and neurotransmitters, then that's what affects how we feel, and that's what generates a different feeling for you than Willie about the marijuana and anything else. We're all so different on what generates our pleasure, what generates our rage, and hopefully with age we discover more and more about ourselves.
Okay, let's give a warm hand, Dr. Pavlovsky.